Well, we're coming back now to the book of Job, where we'll begin in the third chapter this morning. Job is the story of a man undergoing a very severe testing of his faith. As we've seen in chapters 1 and 2, quite unconscious that he was being made a test between God and Satan, Job has experienced a tremendous series of calamities that has wiped out all that he held of value. In one tragic day, he lost all his possessions. And on the same day, he lost his 7 children, 4 young men and 3 young ladies. And subsequently, he lost his health. He was afflicted with a very loathsome and repulsive disease that left him covered with boils from head to foot and disfigured his countenance, turned him into a very repulsive looking man. And then to top it all off, his wife turned against him and suggested he take his own life, curse God, and commit suicide. And yet, despite all these pressures, Job is still trusting in the mercy and the love and the grace of God. And despite all that he has gone through, he still refuses to do what Satan is trying to get him to do, to curse God and die. And the book so far has already proved a rebuke, I'm sure, to many of us who have been confronted with far less temptations, and we have found ourselves doing what Job was tempted to do, to curse God, to take him to task, to resent what he does, and to refuse to acknowledge him as a just and a good and loving God. So at this point in the book of Job, Satan moves up his big guns. He leads 3 of Job's friends to come and comfort him. And we saw this in our last study together. When these friends arrive, they're first of all shocked at what they see. Their dear friend Job, respected, admired, a most attractive man, is now sitting like an empty hulk, sitting on an ash heap, scraping the pus from his sores with a piece of broken pottery. And so repulsive to look at, they can hardly recognize who he is. And they're silenced by this, and they sit in silence for 7 days before they can muster up any courage to speak to Job about his troubles. But it's also apparent as we get into the story that while they waited in silence, they began to grow suspicious that perhaps what Job was going through was something he really deserved. And we'll see how Satan uses this to increase the torment and anguish of this troubled man, Job. Now, chapter 3 begins a round of dialogue between Job and his friends, which constitutes the major part of this book. Therefore, the reason why it is given to us will be revealed in this discussion as it unfolds between Job and his 3 friends. And chapter 3 opens with a bitter lament from the lips of Job. Weeks now have gone by since he was first afflicted with this painful disease, and he has been suffering such pain of heart and pain of body that it's been unceasing torment and misery for weeks. And Job is baffled by the silence of God. God doesn't seem to explain what he's doing. Job knows nothing of what we have been informed of in the opening chapters of this book, and so baffled and buffeted and tormented with physical misery, he now opens his mouth with a tremendous cry in which he longs for death. I don't know if you felt that way. I think there have been times when I've wished I could drop out of the scene entirely, go home to heaven, get out of it all. I'm sure many of you have felt that way. Just this very week, we received a card from a friend who's speaking of a trial that we were going through. She says, "You may feel so very helpless now," which you indeed you are, for the most part. But I know, she says, when you're out there, the crutches are one by one stripped from you. And His words and His love stand before you so irresistibly, so constant, that until Jesus becomes your only alternative. Otherwise, death would be the only seemingly logical relief. Now that's where Job is found here in the opening part of this book. Crying out for death, cursing the day on which he was born. And in this chapter, you'll find he asks three very poignant questions. First one is, why was I ever born? Listen to the beautiful, eloquent way that he expresses that. After this, Job opened his mouth and cursed the day of his birth. And Job said, let the day perish wherein I was born, and the night which said, a man-child is conceived. Let that day be darkness. May God above not seek it, nor light shine upon it. Let gloom and deep darkness claim it. Let clouds dwell upon it. Let the blackness of the day terrify it. That night, let darkness, thick darkness, seize it. Let it not rejoice among the days of the year. Let it not come into the number of the months. Yea, let that night be barren. Let no joyful cry be heard in it. Let those curse it who curse the day, who are skilled to rouse up Leviathan. Let the stars of its dawn be dark. Let it hope for light, but have none, nor see the eyelids of the morning, because it did not shut the doors of my mother's womb, nor hide trouble from my eyes. This book of Job is written in marvelous poetry, and in order that we get as much of it as possible, I'm going to attempt to try to read as much of this book as I can in these messages so that we don't miss the wonderful eloquence of it. I know that may be difficult at times, and I may have to resort to summarizing some of it, but I want you to see how wonderfully these thoughts are expressed for us. And here's an eloquent way in which Job is saying that his birthday, he hopes, will be forgotten. He's looking back to the day of his birth, and he can't change that, of course, but he's saying, may the memory of it, may the anniversary of it, be a day that's ignored in the calendar. Let it be darkened, let it be ignored, let it be cursed. Don't let anybody rejoice in it. Let it be a day of cursing instead of blessing. And the reason he assigns is in verse 10. Because I was born on that day. It produced me. And you can see how at this point his life has become so miserable that he can see no reason for it to go on. So he longs for death. And even all that he's enjoyed up to this point seems of no value in the face of this tremendous anguish that he must endure. Now, all this is given to us in order that we might understand that others have gone through trials far worse sometimes than we have. And Job expresses it in very eloquent terms that we might understand how others have felt under pressures and problems. Job comes very close to cursing God. Now, he never does all through the book. But he does curse the day of his birth. He curses what God has allowed to happen. And you can see how the pressure is increasing on him. And he's beginning to break and crumble under it as this unceasing, unexplained anguish goes on. I don't think anything's harder for us to bear than unexplained trouble. If we can see some reason for what we have to go through, we can endure it much easier. But when it seems to be pointless, nothing seems to be accomplished by it. That's the most terrible strain upon the soul. And that's what Job is experiencing. So he cries out, why was I ever born? Then in verses 11 through 19, his second question is, having been born, why didn't I die at birth? As he says, why did I not die at birth, come forth from the womb, and expire? Why did the knees receive me? Or why the breasts that I should suck? Totally meaningless, he says, my life has been. Better to have died when I was born. And then he goes on to give us his view of death. Now, this is very revealing because, as we'll see, this is a view of death that is not like what we have in the New Testament. It's a much more primitive and natural view of death. It's a kind of a view that many people around us who don't know anything about the Bible at all have of death. And you'll see how Job describes it. Verse 13. For then, he says, I should have lain down and been quiet. I should have slept. Then I should have been at rest with kings and counselors of the earth who rebuilt ruins for themselves, or with princes who had gold, who filled their houses with silver. Or why was I not as a hidden, untimely birth, that is, an abortion, as infants that never see the light? There the wicked cease from troubling, and there the weary are at rest. There the prisoners are at ease together. They hear not the voice of the taskmaster. The small and the great are there, and the slave is free from his master. That view of death sees it as a kind of a rest, just a period of solitude and quiet after the tumult and the trouble of life. And I think many people see death that way. If you've seen the play Our Town, you know there's a very vivid segment of it that describes a visit to the cemetery and the people in the graves talking among themselves. And this is their view of death. Death is the absence of all opportunity to fellowship with others, but it's quiet. It's peaceful. Nobody bothers you there. You go out to the cemetery, and that's the thought you often get. And this indicates that Job's understanding of life after death needs to be enlightened and helped a great deal. That'll be one of the reasons why this suffering came into his life. It's to teach him truth that otherwise he couldn't have known. And at the end of this book, Job's view of death is quite different than it is at the beginning. But many people feel this way about death, that it's just at least a relief from the sufferings of life. Then his third question is, why can't I die now? Why was I ever born? Having been born, why didn't I die when I first came out of the womb? And since that didn't happen, why can't I at least die now? Verse 20, why is light given to him that is in misery, and life to the bitter in soul, who long for death, but it comes not, and dig for it more than for hid treasures, who rejoice exceedingly and are glad when they find the grave? Why is light given to a man whose way is hid, whom God has hedged in? For my sighing comes as my bread, and my groanings are poured out like water. For the thing that I fear comes upon me, and what I dread befalls me. I am not at ease, nor am I quiet. I have no rest, but trouble keeps coming. His argument is, what's the purpose of my life? Why go on? Of what use is a life that's so filled with misery that you can do nothing but just hurt and suffer and feel anguish? What's the purpose of going on like that? My life, he says, produces only fear and trouble. That's all. And so it'd be better to end it now. Many people feel that way. I don't think Job is thinking of suicide. He's just asking God to take him away, take him home. There's no purpose, he says, to life that isn't enjoyable. Now, that's a very common argument. You find it on every side today. And one of the reasons we've been given this book of Job is to help us to understand that there is purpose when it doesn't seem to be there. That life can still have a great deal of meaning and significance, even when for the moment to us it looks absolutely useless. That's why this book is given to us. Now at this point we get the first of the replies of the friends of Job. There were three of them, as we've seen. One was named Eliphaz, and one is Bildad, and the other is Zophar. And these friends all suggest what Job ought to do. They all come with the same solution to the problem, but they approach it in three distinct and different ways, according to their personalities. As I've been reading through this, I've tried to dub them terms that I think gathers up the approach that they take. I call them Eliphaz the elegant, and Bildad the brutal, and Zophar the zealous, because these characterize the approaches they take. Eliphaz is the first speaker, and he's evidently the oldest. There's a smoothness about him and a courtesy that is there at least at the beginning that indicates he's learned how to put things in gracious ways, even though they're not very pleasant. And Bildad is blunt and brutal and plain-spoken and just lays it out on him, and he doesn't care what the result is or how Job is affected by it. And Zophar is very zealous. He's impassioned and emotional, and he speaks with a great deal of impact, trying to move Job. And I think these names will gather up and help you perhaps in understanding something of the approaches these men take. Now Eliphaz the Temanite answers first. His argument breaks down into six main points that he makes. I'm going to read them and kind of gather them up, but when you see Eliphaz and hear what he has to say, you'll see what all these friends are going to be saying all through the rest of the book. He starts out first by saying to Job, in effect, follow your own advice. This is the way he puts it. If one ventures a word with you, will you be offended? Notice the courtesy with which he starts. Yet who can keep from speaking? Behold, you have instructed many, and you have strengthened the weak hands. Your words have upheld him who was stumbling, and you have made firm the feeble knees. But now it has come to you, and you are impatient. It touches you, and you are dismayed. Is not your fear of God your confidence in the integrity of your ways, your hope? Basically, he's saying, Job, you've been a counselor to many people, and you were able to put your finger on their problem and help them to deal with it. You delivered them. You found the key to what was troubling them, and you helped them to face up to it. Now, follow your own advice. Your turn has come. You've been caught in the same kind of a problem you've helped others with, so now follow your own advice, and you'll be relieved. And then he goes on to put it very plainly, just what that problem is as he sees it. And in verses 6 to 11, you have Eliphaz's basic principle of life as he understands it. Think now, who that was innocent ever perished? Or where were the upright cut off? As I have seen, those who plow iniquity and sow trouble reap the same. By the breath of God they perish, and by the blast of his anger they are consumed. The roar of the lion, the voice of the fierce lion, the teeth of the young lions are broken. The strong lion perishes for lack of prey, and the whelps of the lioness are scattered. He uses the imagery here of lions and a family of lions to indicate the natural strength of human beings. It appears to be strong, but in the face of God's judging hand, it's broken. And his argument is, the righteous are never punished. Only the unrighteous suffer. Where did you ever see an innocent man perish, he says to Job. Where did you ever see an unrighteous man succeed? And his argument clearly is that Job's problem is caused by his own willful sin, something Job is hiding. That will be the argument all through the book. The basic principle is that there's something wrong with you, and if you'll just admit it, you'll be all right. I remember years ago picking up a Christian magazine dedicated to attacking men of public ministry like Billy Graham and others. And the editor of the magazine said that Dr. Graham had just had a certain illness. And he stated very plainly, he said, that's a judgment of God on Billy Graham because he associates with the wrong kind of people. And he doesn't do the things he ought to do in his crusades. And so God is judging him because of that sin. But what fascinated me was the next issue, the editor announced that he had fallen down the stairs and broken his leg. But his explanation was that Satan was attacking him, trying to stop his great God-given ministry. And this is so characteristic of humanity, isn't it? We all see other people's suffering is caused by their sin. Our suffering is always caused by something else. And so Eliphaz attacks Job on that line. Now he goes on, and in verses 12 through 21, he says, in effect, if you'll fear God and admit your sin, things will be all right. And he breaks it down into two things for us. First, he says, I learned this truth by a vision that came to me at night. It's kind of a spooky passage. He says, now a word was brought to me stealthily. My ear received the whisper of it amid thoughts from visions of the night when deep sleep falls on men. Dread came upon me and trembling, which made all my bones shake. A spirit glided past my face. My hair of my flesh stood up. It stood still, but I could not discern its appearance. A form was before my eyes. There was silence. And then I heard a voice. Dramatic way, isn't it, expressing this? But he says, I learned this great truth by a vision at night. And here's the truth. Can mortal man be righteous before God? Can a man be pure before his Maker? Even in his servants he puts no trust, and his angels he charges with error. How much more those who dwell in houses of clay, whose foundation is in the dust, who are crushed before the moth. Between morning and evening they are destroyed. They perish forever without any regarding it. If their tent cord is plucked up within them, do they not die? That without wisdom? Now, it's an argument based upon the fact that infinite justice rules the universe. Eliphaz sees God as a God of holiness and purity, so intense, so spotless, that even the angels of God are defiled before him. And what chance would a man have to stand and to claim that he's sinless? Now, in a sense, that's good theology. And as we'll see before the end of the book, it really was a problem that Job was facing. He didn't understand all his own heart, and by the end of the book, he confesses that fact. But the trouble with Eliphaz was he thought it had to be based upon some outwardly known but hidden sin that that Job was unwilling to confess. And he sees God as only a God of justice. He sees nothing of love and compassion and forgiveness, or of discipline and training and the Father's heart of God. And so because of his unbalanced theology, though what he says is true, it becomes false in its application. And that's where a lot of error creeps into the Scriptures. We can quote a lot of good factual truths about the Bible, but when we try to apply them because of a false premise, we'll often end up wrong. That's why people who make a habit of going around with the Bible and quoting verses at people often end up antagonists, beating people over the head with Bible verses and being very wrong in the process. Charles Spurgeon, the great English preacher, used to speak about preachers that he said went around with a theological revolver in their ecclesiastical trousers, ready to pull it out and blast anybody that got in the way. This is what Eliphaz is saying here. Now in chapter 5, verses 1 to 7, he argues, trouble only comes from sin. Call now, is there anyone who will answer you? To which of the holy ones will you turn? Surely, vexation kills the fool and jealousy slays the simple. That's what's wrong. You're vexed and you're jealous. And that's why trouble's coming. I have seen the fool taking root. That is, I've seen him apparently prospering. But suddenly, I cursed his dwelling. It all fell apart. His sons are far from safety. They are crushed in the gate, and there's no one to deliver them. That was a low blow. That was a hidden reference to the calamity that befell Job's children in one day. And Eliphaz is suggesting, you know, that only happens because something wrong in your life. That's it. If your children hurt, it's because something's wrong with you. And he goes on, his harvest the hungry eat, and he takes it out, even out of thorns, and the thirsty pant after his well. For affliction does not come from the dust, nor does trouble sprout from the ground. But man is born to trouble as the sparks fly upward. Trouble comes, you see, from sin. That's the whole thing, he argues. And if you've got trouble, that's what's the reason. Then in the next division, verses 8 through 16, he suggests to Job, there's no use playing games with God. He knows too much. You'll never get by with it. As for me, I would seek God, and to God would I commit my cause, who does great things and unsearchable, marvelous things without number. He gives rain upon the earth and sends water upon the fields. He sets on high those who are lowly, and those who mourn are lifted to safety. He frustrates the devices of the crafty so that their hands achieve no success. He takes the wise in their own craftiness, and the schemes of the wily are brought to a quick end. They meet with darkness in the daytime and grope at noonday as in the night. But he saves the fatherless from their mouth, the needy from the hand of the mighty, so the poor have hope and injustice shuts her mouth. God's in control, he argues. And he is so clever and so wise that you can't deceive him. You won't be able to hide from him. He'll trap you. He'll uncover your sin. You might as well get it out in the open. That's what he's saying. And he closes it with a section in which he says, in effect, just give up and God will bless you. Behold, happy is the man whom God reproves. Therefore, despise not the chastening of the Almighty. For he wounds, but he binds up. He smites, but his hands heal. He will deliver you from six troubles, and seven there shall no evil touch you. In famine he will redeem you from death, and in war from the power of the sword. You shall be hid from the scourge of the tongue, and shall not fear destruction when it comes. At destruction and famine you shall laugh, and shall not fear the beasts of the earth. For you shall be in league with the stones of the field, and the beasts of the field shall be at peace with you. You shall know that your tent is safe, and you shall inspect your fold and miss nothing. Your flocks and cattle will be safe. You shall know also that your descendants shall be many, and your offspring as the grass of the earth. You shall come to your grave in ripe old age, as a shock of grain comes up to the threshing floor in its season. Lo, this we have searched out. It is true. Hear and know it for your good. Clearly, he argues, if you'll just admit and cast yourself on God's mercy, he will forgive you and restore you, and everything will be fine. He'll protect you in every area of your life. And you can be confident that you'll be protected and kept even to a ripe old age. Now, of course, the truth is, that isn't what happens. This is not in line with facts. Anyone who's lived a few years at all knows that you can find godly people who aren't protected, who do go through times of trial and peril and suffering. And though this sounds like good theology, it doesn't take in all the facts. That's why Job is given to us, that we might learn to correct our theology and to understand there are deeper reasons for suffering than just sin. Although that's the argument of Eliphaz here. Now we'll take just Job's reply to this, chapters 6 and 7. And it's divided into two chapters and into two sections. Chapter 6, he rebukes his friends. He speaks to all three of them. And probably there were others there too, listening to this, a kind of a silent audience that we don't hear much from, except a certain young man who comes in toward the end of the book. And in chapter 7, he speaks to God. He addresses his complaint to God. And this is what he says, three divisions in each. First, he says he has a right to complain. Then Job answered, "Oh, that my vexation were weighed and all my calamity laid in the balances, for then it would be heavier than the sand of the sea. Therefore, my words have been rash." He admits that he's been speaking very strongly, but he says, if you were where I was, you'd understand. My sorrow is so terrible that it gives me a good reason to complain. "For the arrows of the Almighty are in me. My spirit drinks their poison. The terrors of God are arrayed against me. Does the wild ass bray when he has grass, or the ox low over his fodder? Can that which is tasteless be eaten without salt, or is there any taste in the slime of the purslain? My appetite refuses to touch them. They are as food that is loathsome to me." He says, you never hear an animal complain when he's well fed and taken care of. They only complain when they don't have something. That's why I'm complaining. And he says, you can't take that which is tasteless and loathsome. You never eat that without trying to improve it with some kind of remedy, salt or something. So he says, I have a right to complain. It helps me to bear my troubles. A lot of people talk that way. I know a lot of people who feel like if God sends them tribulation, they have a right to tribulate a little bit. And most of them do it, too. Job felt that way. That was his argument. What I'm going through is so bad, I have to complain. And then he speaks of his inability to bear more. "Oh, that I might have my request, and that God would grant my desire, that it would please God to crush me, that he would let loose his hand and cut me off. This would be my consolation. I would even exult in pain unsparing, for I have not denied the words of the Holy One. What is my strength that I should wait? And what is my end that I should be patient? Is my strength the strength of stones? Or is my flesh bronze? In truth, I have no help in me, and any resource is driven from me." What he's saying is, I can't take it anymore. I have no strength to handle this. What does God think I am, made of stone or bronze, that he just subjects me to all this? You ever felt that way? You ever said, Lord, you promised that you would not tempt me above that which I'm able to bear, and Lord, we went by that point weeks ago. That's what Job said. But you see, God knows us better than we know us. He knows how much we can take. He knew how much Job could take. And he has a reason for all this. And so Job's cry goes unanswered. And then he turns to his friends and rebukes them. He expresses his irritation at their misunderstanding. "He who withholds kindness from a friend forsakes the fear of the Almighty. My brethren are treacherous as a torrent bed, as freshets that pass away, which are dark with ice and where the snow hides itself. In time of heat, they disappear. When it's hot, they vanish from their place. The caravans turn aside from their course. They go up into the waste and perish. The caravans of Tema look, the travelers of Sheba hope, but they're disappointed because they were confident. They come thither and are confounded. Such you have now become to me." In other words, you friends, he says, you're like a mountain brook that's running full of water in the wintertime when nobody needs it. But when the hot summer sun comes out and you long for the refreshing of the water and you come to the brook to get refreshed, it's nothing but a dry, gravel-filled stream bed. And even the caravans of camels looking for water come hoping to find refreshment, and there's nothing there, and that's what you are. You said you come to comfort me, and all you give me is trouble. And you reproach me and rebuke me. And he's obviously highly irritated at these friends. He says, Have I said, make me a gift, or from your wealth offer a bribe for me, or deliver me from the adversary's hand, or ransom me from the hand of oppressor? That is, did I ask you to help me? I didn't send for you. You came to comfort me, and instead you give me rebuke and reproach, and I didn't ask for it. But he says, teach me and I will be silent. Make me understand how I have erred. How forceful are honest words. But what does reproof from you reprove? Do you think that you can reprove words when the speech of a despairing man is wind? You would even cast lots over the fatherless and bargain over your friend. You'd beat your grandmother, he said. But now be pleased to look at me, for I will not lie to your face. Sounds like President Carter, doesn't it? Turn, I pray, let no wrong be done. Turn now, my vindication is at hand, at stake. Is there any wrong on my tongue? Cannot my taste discern calamity? Basically, he's simply saying, if there's something wrong and you know it, tell me, because I don't know what it is. See, Job's dilemma is he knows God is doing this to him, but he can't find a reason. He knows there's nothing in his life that he hasn't already confessed and dealt with. He's not trying to claim to be sinless. He's just saying, whatever sin has been there, I've handled. And what else? Why is this going on? You don't help me, he says. You accuse me of sin, but nobody tells me what it is. And then he turns to God, and he complains about the hardness of his present experience. Has not man a hard service upon earth? And are not his days like the days of a hireling, like a slave who longs for the shadow and like a hireling who looks for his wages? So I am allotted months of emptiness, nights of misery are appointed to me. When I lie down, I say, when shall I arise? But the night is long, I am full of tossing till the dawn. My flesh is clothed with worms and dirt. My skin hardens, then breaks out afresh. We get upset when we've even got a zit on our face. But Job was full of boils that kept breaking out again and again. My days are swifter than a weaver's shuttle, and come to their end without hope. Then he complains about the hopelessness of the future. Remember that my life is a breath. My eye will never again see good. The eye of him who sees me will behold me no more. While thy eyes are upon me, I shall be gone. As the cloud fades and vanishes, so he who goes down to Sheol does not come up. He returns no more to his house, nor does his place know him any more. He's given up. He thinks he'll never see any relief. That he'll go on this to the end, and then it'll be gone, and that's all. So he has a hopeless future. And out of that sense of meaningless suffering and hopeless darkness, he cries out in honest despair. Therefore, I will not restrain my mouth. I will speak in the anguish of my spirit. I will complain in the bitterness of my soul. Am I the sea or a sea monster that thou settest a guard over me? When I say my bed will comfort me, my couch will ease my complaint, then thou dost scare me with dreams and terrify me with visions. You can't even get any relief by going to sleep at night. So that I would choose strangling and death rather than my bones. I loathe my life. I would not live forever. Let me alone, for my days are a breath. What is man that thou dost make so much of him, and that thou dost set thy mind upon him, dost visit him every morning and test him every moment? How long wilt thou not look away from me, nor let me alone till I swallow my spittle? If I sin, what do I do to thee, thou watcher of men? Why hast thou made me thy mark? Why have I become a burden to thee? Why dost thou not pardon my transgression and take away my iniquity? For now I shall lie in the earth. Thou wilt seek me, but I shall not be. Have you ever felt that way? Lord, leave me alone. I've had enough. Leave me alone. Why are you so intent on making life miserable for me? Why don't you just let me go? So Job cries out in baffled bewilderment. Now, even at this point in the book, there are some certain things we must constantly remember. One is, we know something about this scene that Job doesn't know. We see some purpose in this that he has not yet seen. And that's also true about sufferings that we go through. You see, there's always, in every time of trial, there are two purposes in view. Satan has his purpose and God has his. Satan's purpose was to use the pain of Job's illness to afflict his body, to use the priggish, well-intentioned comfort of his friends to irritate and annoy his soul, and to use the silence of God to assault his spirit and break his faith. But God's purpose is to teach Job some far deeper truths that he never knew before, to deepen his theology and help him to understand God much better. God's truth was to answer Satan in the eyes of all the principalities and powers of the whole universe and to prove him wrong about his philosophy of life. And also, God's purpose was to provide a demonstration for all the sufferers of all the ages that would follow that God knows what he's doing. Now, as the book of Job unfolds, we'll see how this is brought out gradually into the light. But what an encouragement to those of us who must go through some times of suffering to understand that it isn't always because we're sinful. Sometimes it is, and we'll know it when it is. But if, like Job, you know of nothing that you've done, that you haven't faced and dealt with, and still the suffering goes on, look behind the curtain of God's purposes and you'll see that great and eternal events are hanging upon the outcome of that struggle. Let's stand together and we'll be dismissed. Our Father, thank you for the sufferings of Job. What marvelous lessons they teach us, Lord, about our own lives and our own sufferings. Help us to view them in the light of the revelation of this book and to know that we know more truth than Job knew, and we have far less reason to give up than he did. Grant to us, Lord, strength to stand in the midst of pressure through Jesus Christ our Lord. Amen.